Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Daniel Gibbs about his and Theresa Barker's new book, A Tattoo on My Brain, A Neurologist's Personal Battle Against Alzheimer's Disease. Dr. Daniel Gibbs is one of 50 million people worldwide with an Alzheimer's disease diagnosis. Unlike most patients with Alzheimer's, however, Dr. Gibbs worked as a neurologist for 25 years, caring for patients with the very disease now affecting him. Also unusual is that Dr. Gibbs had begun to suspect he had Alzheimer's several years before any official diagnosis could be made. Forewarned by genetic testing showing he carried alleles that increased the risk of developing the disease, he noticed symptoms of mild cognitive impairment long before any tests would have alerted him. In this highly personal account, Dr. Gibbs documents the effect his diagnosis had on his life and explains his advocacy for improving early recognition of Alzheimer's. Weaving clinical knowledge from decades caring for dementia patients with his personal experience of the disease, this is an optimistic tale of one man's journey with early stage Alzheimer's. Well, Dan, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here with us today. So as we have witnessed the unprecedented times of the recent global pandemic, I was wondering if you could start by reflecting on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from the experience.
Well, of course, it's affected everybody. I have to say that in some ways it's been helpful. It's allowed me to concentrate on writing the book during part of that time. Brought me back into the house, I discovered, for example, that I could get all the aerobic activity that I'd been getting at the gym just by walking in the neighborhood and by doing other things. So I was actually able to save quite a bit of time in my day by not having to travel to the gym every day like I had done in the past. So that in a sense was a benefit, but of course, the loss of interaction with family and friends was hard, as it was for everybody.
And do you have a dog that you could also walk during this time to get a bit of exercise?
Oh yeah. Yeah. My dog Jack is an English Cocker Spaniel, and we walk every day about 10,000 steps, probably 4.5 miles. And we live right next to a forest park. We get quite a bit of elevation gain, about 450 feet on our walk. So I track my heart rate and I usually get it up to about 120. So it's good aerobic exercise. And sometimes I have to urge him on. He gets a little tired on our walks, but we're doing fine there.
Mm. You've recently written a very interesting article in Scientific American, and in there you say that you can really discriminate between dogs, can you?
That's right. So one of the interesting things about Alzheimer's disease is that almost everybody, I think, it's very, very common for people to lose the ability to recognize faces. It's called face blindness or prosopagnosia, and it's due to damage to the fusiform gyrus of the temporal lobe, which is one of the early parts of the brain that is damaged in Alzheimer's disease. So it's very common for people with even early stage Alzheimer's to start to have problems with recognizing even familiar faces. And of course, with the pandemic, we're all wearing masks, and that just puts one more layer of difficulty in facial recognition. And I relate this anecdote experience that happened to me last year when I was out walking the dog, and I came across about a year and a half before, there were three young women on our block who all gave birth to babies within a month or two of each other. And they all had dogs, and two of them had dark hair and one of them had blonde hair. And so I was out walking the dog, and I came across this blonde woman wearing a mask, pushing a stroller and walking a dog. And I took her for the neighbor that lives across the street from me. And we started chatting, and she was very friendly. And you know, I asked her how old her child was now. And then as she started to walk away, I realized that she had the wrong dog. the blonde across the street from me has a black Labrador retriever. And this was some sort of, you know, curly-haired terrier. And it dawned on me that this was a total stranger. And I had been unable to recognize her because she was wearing a mask and because of my Alzheimer's disease. So I actually wrote about that experience in a blog that I used to kind of update the book. And it got picked up by an editor from Scientific American. And he asked me to expand the blog into a short opinion article about face blindness during the pandemic. And so that was kind of a fun experience. And so I sent the article to each of these three women, and they all got quite a kick out of it about the misidentification. Which raises another point. You know, I have Alzheimer's disease, but I'm not shy about talking about it. And we discuss it with the neighbors, and I'm actually quite an advocate for the early recognition of Alzheimer's disease. So I speak about it fairly frequently. One of the things I really am trying to get across is to try to decrease the stigma that's attached to Alzheimer's so that we're not afraid to talk about it with even casual acquaintances.
So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I am a retired neurologist. I'm 70 years old, and I have early stage Alzheimer's disease. I have a background in neuroscience as well. I did both MD and PhD degrees in medical school, and actually had no intention of practicing medicine. I wanted to be a biomedical scientist. And after medical school, I did a year of internal medicine internship. I'm not sure what the equivalent is in Europe, but 1 year of clinical training. And then I went into a research fellowship in neuroendocrinology, which had been my graduate field. But after 4 or 5 years, after the fellowship, I was on the faculty at University of California, San Diego, doing research in the neuroendocrinology of the stress response. And after 4 or 5 years doing that, I decided to go back and finish my clinical training in neurology. And I had the plan all along to go back into academic medicine, but I really fell in love with actually taking care of people with neurological problems. And when I emerged from the neurology residency, I had actually been offered a position at the medical school, and I at the last minute changed my mind and went in and joined a group practice in Portland, Oregon, and practiced general neurology for the next 25 years. I also taught general neurology both to medicine residents involved with the hospital I worked at, but also at the local medical school. I taught neurology residents and finished up my career the last 3 years at the medical school as director of the residency training program.
So during your career journey, what roles did your family, mentors, and your colleagues play? And maybe you have some advice for our younger listeners, like early career researchers who are considering perhaps having a career in neurology.
Well, neurology I find it a fascinating area because it is so intellectually stimulating. Every branch of medicine has its, I shouldn't say boring, but it's routine cases that are seen, but they're still satisfying if you can help somebody get through the headaches or whatever. But in neurology, I don't think there was a week that went by during my 25 years when I didn't have a patient that was a real intellectual challenge in order to make a diagnosis and to come up with a treatment plan. So it was, I think it's a great specialty to go into for those who are seeking a real intellectually challenging and stimulating career. When I was in medical school, I had a friend who told me that his father or something had told him that that he was a neurologist and he'd gone into research because it was so frustrating practicing neurology, because back then, this would have been in the 70s, there was nothing you could do for almost all the neurologic problems. And that's changed tremendously. For example, when I first was in practice, there was very little that we had to offer for people with multiple sclerosis. I think it's called disseminated sclerosis in the UK and in Europe, but and that's changed totally. And even during the 25 years I was practicing, I can think of at least one patient who I saw throughout those 25 years who at the end of the 25 years, you would not have any idea that she had MS because we have now disease modifying medications that can control multiple sclerosis. And that's where the challenge now is to approach some of the more complicated or treatment-resistant disorders like Alzheimer's disease and the other dementias that we still don't really understand how to get at them. But we're going to make it. I mean, I think there will be breakthroughs in the years to come. So it's a very exciting field.
That's a really hopeful message. So you are in this unique position of wearing two hats. So one of them is being an expert in neurology with a very, very deep knowledge of the field, but also being a person with Alzheimer's, as you said. And your latest book brings us really intimate account about both of these areas, really. So I was wondering, why did you call it A Tattoo on My Brain?
I actually came up with the title before I started writing the book, the title came and went. I actually came up with a different title later on that I thought was a little more quirky. But I was told, and the people told me so, were absolutely right that it was not esoteric's not the word, but that most people wouldn't get it. And that title was, from dopamine to amyloid. And that was based on the fact that my early research was on the role of dopamine in regulating prolactin secretion. And you know, back in the 70s, it was still unclear whether dopamine was a physiologic inhibiting factor of prolactin secretion. And the work I did as a graduate student proved that it was. And ironically, that was the most cited paper of my career, was the one I wrote as a graduate student, because it was it was the last brick in the pyramid that others had built right up to that point. It wasn't that my contribution was all that great. But that was the idea of going from dopamine, you know, the kind of the high. And there's this also overlay of dopamine being a neurotransmitter of reward. So, you know, kind of the highs of my life, you know, going towards the amyloid and the depths. But that was abandoned. And I went back to the tattoo on my brain. And I'm glad I did, because that represents... it's a metaphor it's grounded in the fact that one of the side effects I had from a trial of anti-amyloid monoclonal antibody was bleeding into my brain along with swelling of my brain. And those multiple areas of hemorrhage called, there are microhemorrhages, or hemosiderosis, resolved completely, as did the edema over a number of months, the swelling. But what was left was the hemosiderin, the iron-containing pigment that's contained in blood, and that will probably be there for the rest of my life. So in a literal sense, I actually have a tattoo on my brain, because the hemosiderin is not all that different from the ink that would be used in making tattoos. But in a figurative sense, it also works as a mark of Alzheimer's that I carry with me as a sort of grounding point, if you will.
Mm. Oh, that is so interesting! Wow. So, how did you come to writing this book? Why was it important for you to write it?
Well, I thought I had a story to tell. Because of I had those two perspectives, and looking at my disease as a scientist and a physician, as well as somebody who has Alzheimer's disease, and there are a lot of misconceptions about Alzheimer's that I thought needed to be addressed, and in particular. I think as a society, we have this view of Alzheimer's disease as being a fairly short, rapidly progressive dementia that lasts 8 to 10 years, and you're dead, from the onset. And of course, that was the very first patient, Auguste Dieter, who. Was the patient of Dr. Alois Alzheimer, followed that pattern. She died just about 7-8 years after she first came to medical attention. But the point is that those are the late stages of Alzheimer's disease. And the disease actually is a much longer disease. The neuropathology, the amyloid plaques, and then the neurofibrillary tangles begin, at least the amyloid plaques, begin about 20 years before cognitive impairment starts. This has been a mostly ignored part of the disease. And I think it's really important to change the conversation about Alzheimer's and the awareness of it, because I think the sweet spot for treatment is going to be in these early pre-symptomatic stages. And there's already a lot of evidence that I talk about in the book about lifestyle modifications that can slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease, but they have to be started in that pre-symptomatic stage of the disease. If we wait until the end game, which is what we've always thought of as Alzheimer's dementia, it's too late. You know, that there already are too many dead cells, too many dead neurons, the brain is shrinking, and getting any benefit from any treatment at that point is going to be very difficult, and we don't have anything that we know that will work there. I'm trying to change the conversation, or to help change the conversation. I'm not the only person doing this, obviously. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend testing, at least not for everyone. There are very good tests available, with more on the way in the next few years, that will allow us to identify people who are on the Alzheimer's arc. There are PET scans now detecting the amyloid protein and the beta amyloid, and also the abnormal tau. Now, they're very expensive, and insurance, at least in the United States, don't cover these yet, so they're not going to be in general use. But there are blood tests in the works. They're being used for research purposes now, that are very sensitive for detecting tau, the abnormal protein in neurofibrillary tangles. And there's one test that's specific for tau that's induced by amyloid. So that is that may be a very good biomarker for someone on the Alzheimer's progression. These tests don't necessarily need to be done on everybody. But people who have a family history of Alzheimer's, particularly a parent or a sibling, are at significantly increased risk. And they're the ones who, whether they get tested or not, should be thinking about adopting the lifestyle modifications that are clinically based, that are evidence-based, and that have been proven to slow the progression of Alzheimer's and reduce the risk of actually getting clinical Alzheimer's dementia. That's a message I'm trying to get out there. Also, people at risk, people who have a family history who are in middle age, may want to think about joining a research study, because there are a number of trials for various approaches to treating or preventing Alzheimer's that need people who don't yet have symptoms, but yet do have neuropathological changes in their brain already. So I think that's an important thing. The point is that we need to start these things in middle age, not wait until people already have symptoms.
So what do we know about the factors that contribute to development of Alzheimer's so far?
Well, interestingly, the risk of ApoE4 may actually be higher than 12 times for two copies. There is a very interesting paper within the last year from Ryman's group at the Banner Clinic in Arizona, where they used several thousand autopsy-confirmed brains, autopsy-confirmed Alzheimer's disease. And this is the first time this has been done, and then comparing it to their ApoE4 status. And they found that having two copies of ApoE4 actually increased risk by 30-fold, not 12-fold, compared to having two copies of ApoE3, which is the combination that's considered to be of neutral risk. ApoE is a very important risk factor, but it's not a determinant. Not everybody with ApoE4 gets Alzheimer's disease, but if you have two copies, your risk goes way up. Now there are genes that are determinant. They're rare, but there are three genes for autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease: presenilin-1, presenilin-2, and APP. What does that stand for? I'm sorry, I can't remember. Yeah, thank you. So if you have one copy of those, you will get Alzheimer's, and it occurs at an earlier age, usually in the 40s or 50s. But those only account for less than 2% of Alzheimer's. ApoE4 is found in about 60% of people with Alzheimer's. So some people get Alzheimer's without ApoE4 and without one of the autosomal dominant ones, and they may have some combination of the many other genetic risk factors. but it's a growing field. There's a lot of interest in it, but family history is a big part of your risk for Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are other things. Having had head injuries increases the risk for getting Alzheimer's later on. There's been a lot of interest recently in what we call soccer, and in Europe would be football players who play at the professional level and are heading the ball and sustaining subclinical head injuries. And there's an increased risk of dementia, including Alzheimer's disease, in that population. Same is true of prize fighters, boxers, and other people who get repetitive head injuries. And there are other less well-documented risk factors for Alzheimer's, but the big ones are genes who your family is.
So you mentioned a little earlier the lifestyle modifiers that can have impact on either development or the progression of Alzheimer's. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, absolutely. So the evidence is best, and there's overwhelming evidence that getting an adequate amount of aerobic exercise reduces risk significantly. In the rate of progression of Alzheimer's pathology and in the risk of having a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease later on. And those actually may be the same things, but was just different time points looking at them. Strength exercise, lifting weights and all that, it certainly doesn't hurt, but it doesn't seem to have that same benefit. It's a question of getting the heart rate up. And in fact, in general, you know, what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So most of these lifestyle modifications are part of a heart healthy lifestyle as well. Certainly the aerobic exercise is. The second one is diet. And the evidence is perhaps a little less firm on that. But it appears that there is very good evidence that a plant-based Mediterranean-style diet does slow the progression of Alzheimer's, you know, if started before symptoms occur. So not all studies show that, though. So there's a little bit of controversy there. The data is a little bit better for a modification of the Mediterranean diet called the MIND diet. And I think that stands for Mediterranean-Intervention for Neurodegeneration, I think. That's been out for about 6 or 7 years. And it's essentially the same as the Mediterranean diet with a greater emphasis on foods containing that are rich in flavanols, including berries and nuts. Again, it's mainly plant-based. And that's the diet that I try to follow. I'm certainly not 100% on it. One of the interdictions on the MIND diet is cheese. You're only supposed to have one serving of cheese a week. And I love cheese. So I'm a failure on that. But the studies of the MIND diet have showed that even partial adherence to it does provide some benefit. So you don't have to go all out on it. But in general, avoiding the red meats and eating a plant-based diet seems to be beneficial. Now, then we get to the ones that are a little bit more controversial. That is intellectual stimulation and social stimulation. And I shouldn't say controversial. I mean, nobody thinks they're bad, but the question is, how much does staying intellectually stimulated help? And it probably depends on what sort of intellectual stimulation that you get. It seems to be most beneficial to do intellectual exercise that involves new learning. And, you know, I think of it as laying down new synapses in the brain rather than just repeating things. And I love to do crossword puzzles. I do them. I do the New York Times crossword every day while I'm having my lunch. But some of the scoffers point out that doing a lot of crossword puzzles makes you good at doing crosswords, but it doesn't really, you know, help your memory. And the way I approach that is that that may well be true, but I try to make doing crosswords a learning experience as well. So when I get towards the end of the week when the crossword puzzles are getting pretty hard, they almost always will pop up with a word or a place that I've never heard of before. And so I stop and do a little research, you know, Google that word or that place and try to learn something about that lake or whatever, just to learn something new. The other thing is like, you know, playing a musical instrument. Doing music is one of the things that's preserved in our brain much longer than most things. It's part of the procedural memory largely that is contained more in the basal ganglia and cerebellum. And we musicians can play things long after they can do other things when they have Alzheimer's disease. But again, it probably is more helpful if you're a musician to not just play the old things that you learned as a child or whatever, but to learn new pieces, and that may be putting down new pathways. And that's what I try to do. I'm an amateur pianist. I'm not really very good at all, but you know, I can still play the things I learned as a child. Although it's getting a little harder to play some of them. But I do try to learn new pieces as well, and I think that may help. The last thing, the social part of it, I should also mention. Staying socially engaged seems to be important, and that's particularly hard in Alzheimer's because most of us with Alzheimer's lose our sense of empathy and for a variety of reasons, social engagement is harder. One of the first parts of the brain that is damaged, at least with amyloid pathology, is the prefrontal cortex, which is where we get our motivation to do things. And I certainly feel that. I just can't get motivated to do things or to go see people. But it's probably important to make an effort to do that and connect with people. There is some evidence to support that. One of the things that I experience in social engagements that I find difficult is that it's increasingly difficult for me to understand people talking, especially if there is more than one person talking at the same time. I can no longer fill in gaps in a conversation from context. And so even when my wife says something to me, I almost always have to ask her to repeat it again because if I miss the first part of what she says, I can't make sense out of the rest of it. So I have to have her repeat it. And of course, that's very annoying to her, although she's patient. But in a group, it's just impossible. Even a family group, I just have to sit back and I have a hard time following banter, you know, across the dinner table because I just can't disentangle the various conversations. So, you know, there are two parts to the social thing. One is that it's much more difficult for us to do when we have Alzheimer's, but it probably is important to make the effort to do it. The last thing, unless I've forgotten one, for lifetime modification is relatively new, and it seems to be more specific for Alzheimer's rather than cardiovascular health, and that's sleep. There are an increasing number of studies that show that getting adequate sleep does slow the progression of Alzheimer's, reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. And the sweet spot seems to be about 7 to 8 hours. There was just an article that came out within the last month in JAMA Neurology, and actually in today's copy of Alts Forum that is a really good summary of breaking news in Alzheimer's research. It was also covered that showed that people who get six or less hours of sleep are much more likely to have amyloid in their brain and are much more likely to have Alzheimer's or to get Alzheimer's. And the interesting thing on that paper was that at the other extreme of sleep, it also was bad. So people who got more than 9 hours of sleep a day also had more amyloid in their brain and had they didn't really have Alzheimer's cognitive impairment, but they had I can't remember the details, but I think it was a problem with executive function as opposed to the testing that was done in the people with less sleep. But and of course this begs the question: are they getting less sleep because they have Alzheimer's, or is less sleep causing Alzheimer's? And that still has not been worked out. Or vice versa, are they getting more sleep because they've got some sort of sleep disorder that may be contributing to the Alzheimer's, or you know what's causing what? But there, as a parallel bit of research, there is a growing interest in what's called the lymphatic circulation in the brain, and this is a perivascular series of vessels that carry fluid, essentially cerebrospinal fluid, through and across the brain, and it is the flow through this lymphatic system is most prominent during non-REM slow wave sleep. So this has been dubbed, brainwashing, because there does seem to be removal of toxins and possibly also beta amyloid, at least in animal models. So that may be one reason why getting sleep is important. And so I do try to get at least 7.5 hours of sleep every night. And fortunately, I don't have any trouble sleeping, so it's not a problem.
So can you tell us, how did you find out about your condition? And did you have, were you more attuned to the symptoms because of your vast knowledge of Alzheimer's before that?
No, it's kind of an interesting story. I had no inkling of Alzheimer's risk. Both of my parents died early from cancer, so there was no obvious family history of Alzheimer's. In retrospect, probably my first symptom of Alzheimer's occurred back in 2006 when I first noticed that I was having trouble smelling. As I mentioned in the book, I was out walking with my wife and the dog, different dog back then. And I noticed that as we passed these roses in front of somebody's house, I bent over to smell them, and I couldn't get any smell at all. And I commented to my wife that was odd, that was a really nice-looking rose, but it didn't seem to have much of a scent. And she smelled it and said, it smells great to me. So that was that was the first inkling. My smell wasn't gone entirely, but it was just an inkling. And I just attributed that to getting older. Everybody, who, as we age, we lose a certain amount of our ability to smell. And if we live to age 95, virtually everybody is anosmic. So that's aging is the number one thing that causes a decrease in smell. And I was in my 50s then, so not particularly old, at least by my current standards. But then about a year later, I started to get these very interesting illusory odors called phantasmias. They were stereotypical. No, they were always the same. At the beginning, they smelled like a mixture of baking bread and perfume. So it was a very pleasant smell. It would last at least a couple of minutes, but sometimes as long as an hour. And at first, they occurred quite frequently, several times a week. And as the years went on, they became less frequent and finally went away altogether about 5 years ago. But during this period of time, my true sense of odor diminished to the point that it was absolutely gone. And I actually started testing my sense of smell and was able to graph the fact that it was deteriorating from being in the low range of hyposmia or poor smell to anosmia, which is no smell at all. So I had this odd thing of losing my sense of smell entirely, and my general doctor was more excited about it than I was, and she insisted that I get an MRI scan of my brain, and I poo-pooed it, but I went ahead and got it. And surprisingly, it showed this very large pituitary tumor called a macroadenoma. And so I thought, well, gosh, this is what's causing the decrease of smell. And these are benign tumors, but when they get very large, they can cause damage to particularly the optic nerve, and this was actually pressing on my optic nerve. So it was lucky that I caught it when I did. And so I had it removed, and I was sure that this would solve the smell problem, that my smell would start getting better. And that was why I started tracking it with the smell test. But it didn't. My smell continued to deteriorate after that tumor was removed in, I think, 2007, until, as I say, it was gone completely by 2010 or so. And then in 2012, I accidentally found out that I have two copies of APOE4. And that came about because my wife is an amateur genealogist and wanted us to get our DNA tested to flesh out a couple of pathways in our family trees. And at that time, there were also results for various health risk factors. And there was one locked box for two neurological genes of interest. And you had to acknowledge that you should get genetic counseling before unlocking these boxes. But I said, I don't need that. And the reason I was interested is that one of the genes was the LRRK2 gene, which is the most common cause of hereditary Parkinson's disease. Now, most Parkinson's is idiopathic, which just means we don't know what causes it. But about 20% is hereditary, and most of those, the majority of them, are due to a mutation in the LRRK2 gene. And so I thought, well, maybe I'm on the path to get Parkinson's, because I knew that about 80% of people with Parkinson's disease lose their sense of smell years before they have any of the motor or gait problems of Parkinson's disease. So that's why I unlocked the box. And of course, I didn't have the LRRK2 gene, but the other gene there was APOE. And I was shocked to find out I had two copies of APOE4. And at that time, I was cognitively totally normal, had no problems at all. But I did have a friend who was a dementia specialist do some off-the-record computerized cognitive testing. And it came back showing that I was normal, and I scored in the 95th percentile in all domains, all cognitive domains that were tested but one, and that was verbal memory. And I was only in the 50th percentile for verbal memory. Now, of course, that's normal, But in looking at it in comparison to how I performed on the other cognitive domains, it was the first suggestion that there was something not quite right in those parts of my brain that were involved with verbal memory. So that got my attention. And over the next couple of years, I really did start to notice some cognitive trouble, that mild things that most people would dismiss as just part of aging. I had trouble learning the telephone number of my new office. I had trouble recalling names of colleagues and sometimes neighbors. So then I retired in 2013 just because I was concerned that I was on the path to having a significant cognitive impairment, and I didn't want to still be practicing medicine if I had any cognitive impairment at all. So that was 2013. In 2015, I underwent my first comprehensive neurologic cognitive test down at University of California in San Francisco. The cognitive tests, again, were normal, but did show the same relative low scoring in verbal memory. So I was given a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment at that time. And I was asked to join a study that was underway there in San Francisco of people at risk for Alzheimer's disease. It was a neuroimaging study to do PET scans for amyloid and tau over several points in time to see what happened. And at that time, the tau ligand was experimental. It has since been approved. And the amyloid PET scan that I had was done with the Pittsburgh compound, which is not a commercially available one, but it's still used quite a bit in research. It's difficult to use on a commercial basis because the half-life is so short for the ligand. So I had those scans, and then I was able to look at them. I also had 2 days of cognitive testing and a high-resolution MRI scan. And I was able to look at everything at the end. And it was fascinating because there was, on the amyloid scan, a moderate amount of amyloid particularly in the prefrontal cortex, also in a little bit in the precuneus. What I thought was really cool was that there was also amyloid in some of the olfactory processing areas, particularly in the mesial orbital frontal cortex and in the piriform cortex. And that even though pathologically Alzheimer's pathology has been shown to occur very early, particularly in the olfactory bulb, this is the first time I think that anyone had been able to demonstrate at least amyloid in areas that are involved with olfactory processing. So there were about 30 people in the room at this conference, and we were all kind of taken by how cool this was. And this is an example of my two hats, because it was really interesting to see that as a neurologist and neuroscientist. And actually, that was sort of a defense mechanism for me, and has been all along, in being able to intellectualize the experience and the data and not be frightened by it. So 3 years later, we repeated the PET scans and cognitive testing. By that time, I did have some definite cognitive impairment, and the amyloid had spread. And the tau, I didn't mention the tau PET showed just a little bit of tau in the mesial temporal lobes, which is where it begins, pathologically. But 3 years later, the tau had spread posteriorly through the temporal lobes, bilaterally, but more on the left. And that was really interesting, and follows what we see. A tau... I think this is the area of interest in your lab too, is conformational issues with proteins. The tau seems to propagate almost like a prion, you know, like mad cow disease, in that it abnormal tau protein in the neurofibrillary tangle has an abnormal conformation, an abnormal shape, and then it transmits that abnormal shape to tau in neighboring neurons. So neurofibrillary tangles and tau, unlike amyloid, tend to spread in the brain from neuron to neuron, whereas amyloid tends to kind of pop up in different places and doesn't seem to have a connected pathway, whereas tau does. And this was a really nice example of that in my own tau PET scan. I'm losing my thread here. Where are we going?
Yeah, that makes really good sense. And I was just wondering, how did you find it yourself? Was it easy to communicate with your doctors about it? Because you're already so knowledgeable about all of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, I've become actually quite good friends with Gil Rabinovich, who's the principal investigator for these studies at UC San Francisco. He's actually been a mentor. He was the one who really first urged me to write about my experiences as a neurologist with Alzheimer's disease. And that resulted in an opinion paper that I wrote in 2019 for JAMA Neurology. And he's gotten me involved with several conferences and introduced me to people in the field. So he's been a friend, a mentor, and one of my doctors. Also, the neurologist I see here in Portland, Joe Quinn, is a friend. We go back to the days of he was a neurology resident at the medical school here a few years after I finished, but so I supervised him a little bit, and now he's middle aged and he's a great dementia specialist.
So you raised a very important point about conveying your experiences to general public. So what is the importance of a patient advocacy in medicine, and do we need to get patients working with the practitioners?
Well, it's a two-part question, really, because it involves both the practitioners and the patients. I think there's been a longstanding problem, and I was guilty of this as well when I was first in practice and well into my practice, of neurologists and other doctors being not very interested in managing Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, because especially back before the discovery of drugs like donepezil and other cholinesterase inhibitors, we had absolutely nothing to offer people with Alzheimer's disease other than encouragement and placement. And it was a very depressing thing. And I think most of us, at least myself, I was guilty of avoiding tackling the issue head on, and I feel bad about that. But I think some of that sentiment is still is around among general doctors, that they feel like there's not much to do once the diagnosis has been made or suggested, and that's just not the case. There's a lot to offer people with Alzheimer's disease now, not just medications, but in terms of social help, getting them involved in activities, helping caregivers, getting involved in exercise, music, art programs. And in the U.S., the Alzheimer's Association has been really, really important in developing those community resources and in reaching out to doctors to have them refer patients to them for help, to refer families to them, really, for help in managing the disease and the troubles that sometimes can come with it. So there's an education point for doctors, and that was the point of the paper that I wrote in 2019, that was directed at other neurologists. And I was trying to make the point for early recognition of Alzheimer's disease and early management. And by that, I meant getting people involved in lifestyle modifications and getting involved in research studies if they were on the road to Alzheimer's or other dementias. And now I'm trying to reach a greater group, which is, you know, the population as a whole, particularly people in families with Alzheimer's, to recognize what their risks might be going forward, and that middle age is the time to start modifying that risk, if possible. And it may be more important than anything we can offer once the dementia has started.
Excellent point. And bringing this discussion to the forefront of people's minds to really tackle the stigma and start discussing it, start talking about it.
So, that's right. I was just going to say I've found that that people are very open to discussing it and are surprised. Of course, you know, people today, when they find out I have Alzheimer's disease, oh no, you can't have Alzheimer's disease, you know, because I don't fit the picture of what that people have in their minds of Alzheimer's, which is the poor soul in the nursing home who can't speak and can't recognize family members. That's the end stage. And that's what we want to put off as long as possible by making these changes earlier in the disease.
So then what discoveries about yourself or society along your journey to writing your book, A Tattoo on My Brain, surprised you the most?
What surprised me the most? I guess I've been pleasantly surprised by the openness that people have in starting to talk about Alzheimer's earlier in the disease. I get a lot of emails from people who have Alzheimer's in their family or who have found out that they have the APOE4 allele. I think the more we talk about it and the more we talk about proactive things that could be done to reduce risk, the more comfort people have in talking about it more, because it's been, it used to be a disease that we felt had no hope to offer, but now there is hope to offer. We just have to start doing that early and not waiting till it's too late.
And this is something that really struck me in your book, that you really have this optimistic outlook on this quite severe disorder, and disorder that most people fear very, very badly.
Yeah. And, this may not be a politically correct thing to say, but one way that I look at it is that what I want to do personally for my own Alzheimer's disease, and what I would hope other people would do as well, is to do everything I can to slow the progression of my disease to the point that I'll die of something else before I die of Alzheimer's. That may sound like an obvious thing, but that's really what it's all about. If we live long enough, most of us, the majority of people, will have some degree of Alzheimer's pathology in their brain, by the time they're in their 90s or not. But they didn't die of it. They it's still not affecting them very much. And we want to put off the time to make more good life available for everybody, and make it so that Alzheimer's doesn't rear its ugly head until we've been able to die of something else.
Yes, exactly. So we increased our lifespan. Now we need to increase our health span to match it.
Absolutely. That's a good way to put it.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on or are engaged in? What kind of projects, and what will you do next?
Well, I'm still working on advertising the book, not because, I want to make any money on it. If I ever do make any money, it's going to be donated to Alzheimer's research. But I want to get the word out about the importance of early recognition and management. And to that point, I've also, I'm working fairly steadily on posting on a blog, tattooonmybrain.com, which I try to bring up to date some of the most recent research on Alzheimer's disease that didn't make it into the book, and also talk about some of my personal experiences with it. So that keeps me busy at times. I don't have any plans for writing another book. I think I've said what I have to say, but I do want to stay involved in the conversation, both nationally and internationally, to try to advocate for Alzheimer's and not on any one specific treatment or intervention, but to just make it easier to talk about it and to promote as much research as possible.
And where can our listeners find more information about your work, your blog too, and the book?
Well, the book is generally available through the places that you would buy a book, either online or in person. Certainly, your local bookstore can order it. I've had a lot of my friends don't like to use the it shall go nameless, the big book distributor, and prefer to buy from a local bookstore. And I would certainly encourage you to do that. They'll be happy to order the book for you. There is a Kindle version and there's an audio version as well. The blog is tattooonmybrain.com. No, there's no A at the beginning. It's just tattooonmybrain.com. And there's you can reach me by email through the blog, and I'm happy to get emails from people. And I continue to write when I have a chance for opinion pieces in newspapers and interviews and magazines.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been truly illuminating discussion.
Well, thanks you so much for having this forum, and I very much enjoyed talking to you.